Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's the Nerdist Writers Panel on the Nerdist Podcast Channel. Ben Blacker talking writing with writers. Writers talking writing
can get pretty exciting.
The talk can be enlightening.
It's very rarely frightening.
Ben Blacker talking writing with writers.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Nerdist Writer Series. Yeah. All right. Welcome to the Nerdist Writing Series, an informal chat about television writing and the business of writing television. My name is Ben Blacker. I'm the co-creator of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, a stage show in the style of old-time radio. For more information, go to thrillingadventurehour.com. Let's get right to it.
Our first panelist is a Los Angeles native. Who, before breaking into television, made a number of short films, which maybe we'll ask him about. Who knows? His first foray into TV is USA's hugely successful Burn Notice. Yes. Right? You're right. It's a good show. The Burn Notice prequel, starring Bruce Campbell, premieres tonight at 9 o'clock. And if you are all very good, we will be out in time to go home and watch it. Please welcome Matt Nix. Our next panelist has written on such acclaimed series as Once and Again, Everwood, Desperate Housewives, and Kings, and The Event. He's also the creator of The Oaks, which was a spec pilot that started a massive bidding war among all the major networks. This was a few years ago. Landed at Fox and was recently made into a miniseries on Britain's ITV. And he'll tell us all about this stuff. It's a fascinating story. Please welcome David Schulner. And finally, our third panelist began his career as a performer, began writing for a couple of short-lived sitcoms, and after briefly working on Home Improvement, he went on to write for Murphy Brown for three seasons, then to The Larry Sanders Show. Yeah. For which he won an Emmy for co-writing the series finale. After bouncing around on a few more shows and creating the series Style and Substance and The George Wendt Show, he joined with comic Dennis Leary to create both the half-hour sitcom The Job and later the FX series Rescue Me. Yes. He's an acclaimed screenwriter. He's written films Analyze This and Analyze That, and America's Sweethearts, among many others. He currently has two pilots in contention, I believe at different networks. Please welcome Peter Tolan.
Yeah, Daddy.
Hi. Oh. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. We usually start out by talking about either, you know, you're breaking into the business or the first thing you get paid for, but I'm curious to know from you guys about your writing backgrounds. Did you write not so much in your, you know, high school years, but after that, as you were becoming adults, and you came out here to Hollywood, we all have to do a certain amount of writing for free. Did you guys do a ton of writing for free before you started getting paid as writers? What was your entree into the business, Matt?
This actually is not going to sound terribly artistic, but I started my first job out of college. I worked at a talent agency, and then I worked in development. And it was really my time in development that convinced me that I should take a crack at writing. It's something that I'd always done sort of as a hobby. And then, frankly, I was in development. I was like, oh, that's the bar. I can totally do that. And then I quit, and after much urging from my wife, and started writing full time. And yeah, I guess I was probably, I think I wrote like three feature specs before I got hired to do kind of, I think it was the worst job Sony has ever had for a screenwriter. It was write a movie that we've already put into turnaround unofficially, but we want to hire the cheapest screenwriter we can possibly find because we don't want to have an embarrassing conversation with Helen Hunt. And I said, I am your man. And I wrote that movie and was actually called to tell, they called to tell me it was dead before I had turned in the script. And I was like, do I still turn it in? And they were like, oh, you haven't turned it in. Oh, yeah. Yes, go right ahead. So that was my glamorous entree into Hollywood.
David, what about you?
I started as a playwright. And so it's two things. I came out here to write for South Coast Rep in Costa Mesa. I've been doing plays. They commissioned two plays of mine, so I came out here from Minneapolis. And I just, at that point, I was just ready to get a change of weather. So I came out here to write the plays and just to be in sunshine. And I started dating a girl who wrote for Dawson's Creek. People can't do that now, right? I guess you have to find someone else to date on another show. But
she may have been 17.
Right.
You can't do that now because it's illegal.
Yes. So she read this play of mine, and she said, I'm not going to give this to my agent because you're going to get the job that I want. And literally, I didn't own a television. I lived in Long Beach, you know, because it was easy for the commute to Costa Mesa. And so she gave a play that I wrote to her agent, and I got the job she wanted.
What was that job?
That was Once and Again. Oh. And Ed Zwick read the play and said, would you like to write for TV? And I said, I honestly don't know how. And he said, don't worry, we'll teach you. So that was, it was the greatest experience I could have hoped for.
Wow.
What happened to the girl?
I ended up marrying her best friend.
We're not content to fuck her over once. Go back for seconds.
She was the maid of honor at the wedding. So I did a big speech. I did a big thank you, like, for my career, my wife. She's doing just fine. So my free writing was playwriting. 10 years. And, you know, you get a $6,000 commission from a theater, and you've hit pay dirt, and you just think, like, you know, I remember my first commission, I was in New York, and I went to Sparrow's to celebrate, and I ordered extra meat on my contract. It was awesome.
So rich.
That's huge. Peter, we talked a little bit about your background as a performer. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that? How did that segue into writing?
Yeah, I was an actor, and there was not much. There wasn't a hue and cry for me to continue in that field. I would get reviews that said he would make a good host. Really, I think that was always great. And at the same time, I started to write plays too in New York, and there was a theater at the time. This was a while ago. The Manhattan Punchline Theater, that's now defunct, and they did an annual festival of one-act comedies, and I figure I can write a one-act. It's just, you know, at least it's not two acts. And I wrote what's really just really a sketch, more than, it's not really a play, it's more of a sketch, but it was performed, and, you know, it was reviewed in the Times, and somebody out here who actually must have stolen their neighbor's Times read it and said, you're very glib, you should be in television. Mm-hmm. And I resisted, actually, for a couple of years. I don't know why, because I was making that kind of money. I was making that playwriting money, which was a lot of money. And then I finally just wrote a Murphy Brown spec script and got hired on the show. And it came out.
And that's not, I mean, we've talked before in previous weeks.
Yeah,
so
that's
that
not
doesn't
what you're
really
supposed
happen.
To do, but that's what I did.
Yeah. So how did that happen? How did your script get into the hands of the Murphy Brown people?
Well, I was ignorant, you know, at the time. Not that I'm no more ignorant today, but I mean, I was ignorant fully about the business. And I worked at an ad agency. I was a copywriter. And I remember going into this will date the whole thing, like on an IBM Selectric, you know, it had the correction strip in it. That was the huge innovation, you know, so that you didn't have to use the whiteout. And I wrote a Murphy Brown script. I didn't know. I think I asked, I was represented by William Morris because I had a partner who is now the executive producer of Nurse Jackie. And we were partners, comedy partners. And so we were represented by them, by William Morris. And I said, I think I want to write for television. And they jizzed, of course, because they were so used to making all that money off the act. And so they gave me, I think, a copy of what a Murphy Brown script would look like, because that's the big thing. I didn't know what it would look like. And I sat after hours in the ad agency and typed this thing out. And then I would just say to my agents, you know, totally ignorant, just say, well, has Diane English read it? Because I really don't want to work on any other show, because I don't really watch television. And my wife at the time, well, I've killed her. So. Not funny. I mean, my wife at the time, I did the time, it's not a big deal, but anyway, my wife at the time, she watched television. See, I didn't, but she watched it, and she used to watch what was on CBS on Monday nights. And that's the only reason I knew. I said, well, that's a show that I could write. So I wrote that show, and I said, that's the one I want to do. I don't really want to work on another show. And so I got hired.
Did you ever find out what they responded to in your script?
They just thought that the characters were very, you know, were very well written, that it was a script that they themselves would have written. Not as good, but no. But, I mean, really, it's hard to write a spec script. But, they just felt it was tonally correct. Mm-hmm. You know, the character sounded right, and the story was right and all that. Mm-hmm. So it was a good mimic, I guess.
And it goes a long way, especially when the way to do it was to write specs of existing shows.
Sure.
Absolutely. David, the same question. I'm curious. Did you ever find out what Zwick responded to in your play?
Yeah, the play was it took place 90 minutes over like 60 years, and each scene was no more sometimes than a half a page, and then it would transition, and you'd be in another year, or you'd be a week later, a day later, and so basically the scenes were no more than a page and a half. They said, that's good for TV. You know? He had hired some other playwrights who were writing like 4 or 5 page scenes, and he said, I couldn't do that. So being able to pack in as much as as you could in as little amount of space was why they hired me.
And Matt,
that was cheap.
Well, sure. That always goes a long way. Matt, am I correct that Burn Notice is your first foray into television?
Yeah, I did... I got a call one day from my agent. I had been writing movie scripts for a long time. And I was working steadily, but nothing was getting made. And then one day my agent called me and said, you're doing television this year. And I said, I thought you had to have done television before to do that. And he said, no, they like feature guys now. And I said, okay. And so he said, come up with some ideas. And then I ended up doing a... NBC had something an idea that they wanted that I did simultaneously with Burn Notice, and I just pitched Burn Notice, and it was the first thing I'd pitched in television, and then they sort of ended up doing it. So that was the process. I didn't really have any perspective on it, but it was great.
But had they been sent the feature scripts that weren't made?
They read a script that I'd written. They'd read a feature script that I'd written and felt that it was tonally right for the network. And then actually, I think this doesn't happen that often for feature writers in television. But I was very fortunate in that. I had done so much. I mean, in order to work consistently for the something like 8 years that I was working in features, I pitched on everything, like every fucking thing you can imagine. 3 different movies about students making porn films. Didn't get any of those jobs, but I, you know, like just all over the place. So I had a lot of experience just... generating stories. I mean, I've been sort of this, hustling feature writer for so long that I was actually more accustomed than I think a lot of feature writers are to coming in and just pitching and, oh, you don't like that? Okay, how about this? I was flexible and I was also fast because, again, in order to stay working as a feature writer, I never stopped looking for work. It didn't matter how many features I lined up. I was always hustling because, you know, that's how you you know, stay employed. And so so it was sort of a combination of those things. And then it was also a very long development process. They didn't make a decision on Burn Notice for, I think, a year. So I was also fortunate in that they had a year to give me notes and have me change things on the script. And so I think I went through three different stories for the pilot script for Burn Notice. And, you know, they liked it and they wanted to change the tone. And so the normal pilot process is you write a pilot and they make it and there's like a month and then it's done. You know, they decide to make it or not make it, and then they make the pilot, and then that takes another couple months, and then it's over. In the case of Burn Notice, it was like a year, so they had a lot of time to get used to me, and that's why I think when the show went ahead, I got to be showrunner rather than feature writer partnered with experienced showrunner.
And that's happened. I mean, USA is now, that's sort of what they do. You know, they'll nurture that talent, and I think the guy from Royal Pains also, it's his first experience not only running a show, but having a series or being on a series.
Yeah, they like they. I mean, I think it's actually a good model for cable. You can't afford to hire, you know, fancy experienced writers. No, but I mean, it's true. Like, you need if Burn Notice had been on a broadcast network, they would have, you know, really done the search for a super experienced, you know, big fancy showrunner. But on cable, if they can have a creator showrunner, it's just better for a whole bunch of reasons. And so I was fortunate in that that was the one that went, not the NBC one. So
let's talk for a minute. That's a nice segue to the pitching process. And I will start with you again. Was USA the only place that you took Burn Notice?
No.
So how did you vary the pitch as you went along? Where did the show come from? What was the initial pitch? How is it? How did it evolve once you did sell it?
It was. It started out as a darker show. I mean, I think probably the. It started out as a show that would have been on FX, and USA. One of the things that I realized in pitching at a certain point was I'd spent much of my career pitching, and I would sort of like pitch as if I was making an argument as to why you should hire me. And it wasn't that engaging. And I would get out of pitches and people would be like, that fellow is smart. He argues well. We will hire the funny guy. And so so at a certain point I realized, like, I'm not the actor you are, or the host. Yes. But I did realize at a certain point that that you really need to give people the experience of watching the show when you pitch. Some sense of what that is. And so rather than just tell the story, I had, by that point in my career, I'd sort of turned a corner with regard to pitching, and I was just like, fuck it. If I make a fool out of myself, I make a fool out of myself. And I started acting scenes out in the room. And so in the case of Burn Notice, it wasn't like I acted whole scenes, but I did do the voiceovers. And so I'd kind of written the voiceovers and I said, okay, so this is kind of what it would sound like, and we have these voiceover components and you know, kind of did them. And so more than anything else, I think that's what sold it, because it's not like there's never been a PI show with a spy or, I mean, there were a lot of reasons that, you know, you could say that that was something that had been done before, but what hadn't been done before was that show plus a guy explaining to you how he does things in interesting, counterintuitive ways, showcasing spy technique, that kind of thing. And so that, I think that had a lot to do with it. So yeah, I varied it some. I think they can kind of tell when you're whoring, you know, like when you go into CBS and you're like, and then there's science while they detect things. They know. But at the same time, you can sort of you can vary things a little bit and tell yourself that it's going to work, and it never does. I mean, it's just not that effective in my experience. I'm not that good at it, I guess. So.
David, take us through the Oaks, because that's a we'll you know, come back to it. Yeah,
aversion to pitching, my complete fear and terror of having to act, you know, just having to perform. So I just I'm not going to do it. I'm going to spend that time writing a spec. So, and that's what I've been doing. It takes me about the same amount of time to write the damn thing as it does to actually do the pitch. So I just wrote this spec, someone read it, and the next day there was an offer to buy it. And in 24 hours, all three networks were bidding on it. And this is after my agent was like, I don't know. You know, you should really pitch. Specs are out.
Pilot about trees. Who's really?
And so in order to, you know, win the bidding war, Fox said they would pick it up straight to Sirius. 13 episodes.
Wow.
Huge penalty if they don't do it. So we said, okay. We started shooting the day of the writer's strike. So it was really, and the process itself was fraught because they had spent so much money on it. And essentially it was a first draft. It was crazy. And they, you know, they blew so much smoke up my ass to get me to buy it. When they started giving notes on it and trying to change the things that they had said they loved, I was not very cooperative, and I, you know, I, not very collaborative. I already have the money in the bank. What were they going to do? So shooting it was miserable. I was picketing the studio where we were filming. So, and essentially we were in Manhattan Beach, so I was, you know, no studio, it's like not like picketing the Fox lot, it was the hairdressers and the gaffers, and I'm like, you know, like picketing outside, and they're like, hey dude, like, hey guys, good job today, tell me how it went on your way out. So it was really miserable, and they ended up getting the finished pilot. They ended up, this was, Jeremy Renner was the lead, Matt Morrison was in it, Michael Questa was the director of Dexter, and really great director. They ended up firing everybody, and we, casting director, everyone, they fired everyone, made us fire everyone, and then they said they weren't actually going to pick it up after all. So in this great integration, 20th spent about $11, $12 million on the pilot. Because, and they built this elaborate set because they thought it was going to be amortized over 13 episodes. So when Fox, their parent company, said we're not picking it up, it was a huge craziness within their company. But luckily, Fox had spent so much, 20th had spent so much money, they were incentivized to try and sell it elsewhere. So they ended up selling it to ITV, the concept to ITV in Great Britain. And they hired one of the Doctor Who writers, very talented guy. And he wrote a six, you know, we broke 13 episodes. We had a show Bible. I hired a staff. We had a room going. So they took all everything that we did, and they made a very successful six-hour miniseries that just finished with 6 million viewers a night. It was number one every night that it aired.
That's some satisfaction.
I had nothing to do with it.
Absolutely. That's it. Did you have nothing to do with it?
I had nothing to do with it.
Are you happy with the product?
I have not seen it. I have the DVDs. It's now called Marchlands. I have the DVDs at home, and every time I go to watch them, I'm like, okay, either it's going to be better than what I did, and then I suck, or it's going to be worse than what I did, and then I kind of suck. I still kind of suck. So I had this real aversion to watching them, but they're sitting on my washing machine. So I will watch them soon. So a long way of saying I've had more success writing specs than pitching. And I've never actually pitched. I still haven't pitched. I'm on an overall deal at NBC, and so now with that kind of thing, they basically are, you go in pitching them something that they're already going, you know, they're going to buy.
So you don't even bother?
Yeah.
So, you
what
know.
Time do you wake up?
I'll tell them about the spec that I just wrote.
Peter, let's go back. I know these guys want to hear about Rescue Me, but I want to hear about The Job. Have you guys seen The Job? It's a great show.
This is really
a great show.
I will say myself.
But that is a great show.
It is a great, it's a legitimately great show. Tell me about pitching that show.
It was really easy because I forget what I had done before, what Dennis. Dennis had a film career of or he kept telling me he did. And I forget what I had done, but we came from a very entitled place on that, where we went to, I think it was at ABC, and we said, look, here's the show we're going to do. And this is the guy, and he's got pill-popping, kind of semi-alcoholic, NyQuil-swigging, you know, philanderer, and he's got a black girlfriend, and he's married, and these are the people who work, and everything like that. And that's the show we're going to do, and if you don't like it, just tell us, and we'll do it someplace else. And that was really the pitch. We just said, that's the show we're going to do. If you don't like it, just tell us, and we'll do it someplace else. So they called the next day and said, does she have to be black? They said, does the girlfriend have to be black? And we said, yes. Okay, go make the show. So that was the big argument. So we really made the show. It was really based on, Dennis had done a remake of the Thomas Crown Affair. He played a detective in that, and he had a technical advisor, a New York City detective named Mike Charles. And Mike's story was just as fucking crazy as anything that was on the screen. And Dennis just looked at the guy and said, we got to do this story. So I didn't know Dennis. I take great delight in saying that I never really thought much of his stand-up. I usually say that to him. It's much better when I say it to him. And I got a call. I was in New York. I don't know why I was in New York, but I got a call saying, Dennis Leary would like to meet you. He lived in Connecticut. I had to take a car all the way to Connecticut, and he had a big Irish wolfhound that went right for my balls as soon as I got, you know.
It sounds about right.
Yeah, I don't really like that. I mean,
but I would expect
network,
no less.
Yes, I see that, but I mean, not in Connecticut. So we met, and he gave me that thing, which I don't know if you guys have ever had this, when you meet with talent, and they know your talent. He knew me from Larry Sanders, right? He knew Larry Sanders. So he said, this guy must be good, but I haven't been good for him yet. So they look at you like this. Waiting to see when you're going to be good for them. So I had that meeting first, and at a certain point I said, well, yeah, we should try to do this. We should, you know, be funny, half hour, single camera thing. There were not a lot of those at the time. And he said, well, I've written some pages to give you an idea of what the character would be, which, you know, I've said a couple times that, you know, like pages from an actor is like a 5-year-old with a Glock. Nothing good can come of it, you know? So he gave, well, it turned out not to be pages. It turned out to be a draft of a script. And I was like, oh, shit, this is getting worse. So I take the script. I said, I'll read it on the way back into the city. And I don't remember much about it. I do remember that there was a reenactment, and this says a lot about Dennis. We're both from Massachusetts. But a reenactment of the Kennedy assassination as a device to get someone to talk. Like they put him in the car and said, all right, we're in Dealey Plaza now, and there's the depository. Now, do you want to tell us anything? And he's like, no. All right, there's the fence. And, you know, and I don't know what the fuck. But as I'm reading it, I realize it's not bad, and the characters are good, and I'm sort of reading through, and then I start to go, okay, what would I write next as I turn the page? And it would be there, or some version of it. And I went, okay. I said, we're going to write this together, which was a huge mistake, because then he assumed that, you know, we would write everything together. If anybody's ever seen Rescue Me or The Job, we never had a single credit. We had a shared credit on everything.
Like the Beatles.
Like, yeah, everything. Didn't matter who wrote it. So anyway, that's how that all came about. And I did not leave the Kennedy assassination, and I changed it. But that's how that came about.
Then let's back up a little bit, because you were in that enviable position to pitch the show that you wanted to do.
Yeah,
but before that, you had pitched a couple of shows. I saw the George Wendt show.
Sure.
You were the creator. And,
there's a lot of shit on there.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up, by the way.
Let's say it's extensive.
Let me tell you. I'll tell you what the problem is. I'm a really good pitcher.
How do you do it?
Well, it's just what Matt said. It really is that you go into the room and you act out the show, and you try to. I mean, first of all, the way I do it is, tell it as fast as you can and get the fuck out, because that's what they want. They're busy people. They don't want you to sit there and talk for 25, 35 minutes about this character and this plot twist and this thing. They don't want to hear that. They want you to come in and go, here's what it is. Boom. And say it as the log line. Say it as, do the 1-minute pitch
Now, presumably, you haven't been shown the door yet. Now you do the 5-minute pitch, where you actually start to flesh out the characters and pitch jokes. If it's a comedy, you pitch actual things that are going to be in the show that you assume will be funny, so you can get a laugh in the room. And then if they're still with you after 6 minutes, now really start to go in and say, here's what could happen over the life of the series. Here's the relationship of this character to this character. Here's how here's the structure of the, you know, get into this. And just at the point you're losing them, you know, feign some kind of an asthma attack and get out. And that's really it. I mean, you know, it's that simple. My problem is I can pitch anything, even the shit. And then you make it and you go, I think this is shit. And then you're stuck doing episodes, and they're all shit. There's no show, you know? You guys haven't done it a lot, but there's times when you do a pilot and you go, what's the next show? I don't think there is one. Then you're right fucked. A lot of those shows.
I want to dwell on this shit for just a minute.
I can tell you read two things. One was the George Wendt show, and one was Style and Substance. Now, nobody knows these shows, and for good reason, although they do have some particular charm. Style and Substance was made for one reason. And this is not an organic reason. I had an overall deal at Disney, and they paid me a lot of money. This was the last of the big overall deals, and I got it. It's the only time in my life I hit it just the right time, you know? So I had all this – I was getting all this money, and I really was doing nothing. And I said to them, don't you want me to read scripts or even clean up behind the Goofy? Goofy's incontinent. Nobody really knows that. And they would say no, and I felt bad. But so this was around the time that Martha Stewart rose to prominence. And they said, we got to do a show about Martha Stewart. And they looked around, and they said, who are we paying so much money? Make him do it. Now, I don't want to do a show about Martha Stewart, but I had a check. So I wrote a show about Martha Stewart. That's why. So is there... is there a passion to that? Is there a passion that drives that show forward? Not necessarily. Was it funny? Yeah, it was good and weird. And it's Jean Smart was in it, and she's great. And Nancy McKeon was in it, and she's a wonderful person. Now hold on. Les Moonves called me and said, "I would really, if you would make me a happy Jew." If you would cast Nancy McKeon as the second lead in this. And I asked him if he would convert. And he said no. And she is a delightful person. She may not have been, I thought she did a very good job. She may not have been the right person. The George Wendt show is a different thing. And these are all just marked by bad choices in history. George, again, a really swell guy, a great guy to work with and fun. But I had made a mistake. Which was, and this happens all the time, and there are countless examples of this, and I'm sure you can all come up with an example. It's when something is wonderful, and you go, that should be a TV show. No, it shouldn't. It's wonderful as the thing it is. That doesn't mean it's going to be a good TV show. And the thing that it was that I liked as a listener was Car Talk on National Public Radio. The two guys who do that car show. And there's something, maybe it's just because I'm from Massachusetts and I miss the accent, I don't know. But there's something very endearing about the relationship of those two guys and the fact that they are unpolished and make each other laugh. And there's an infectiousness to those two guys. When you cast it, when you show them, when you see them, when you have to build a construct to make, it's not the same thing anymore and you've killed it. You've killed the thing that made it wonderful. And that's what I did. And I said at one point in the casting thing, somebody said George Wendt, because Cheers had just ended, and they were trying to recast everybody who'd been at Cheers as a sure thing, as their next thing was going to be a big thing. And I said, I don't think he's right. And I turned it down. And then at a certain point, a month, 2 months, 3 months later, as I'm still trying to cast it, they came back and said, we will make the pilot if you hire George Wendt. And I did it. And I'm not saying that was a bad choice, but because he is a wonderful guy, but maybe it wasn't the right choice. Or maybe I killed it in the first place trying to... It's the same thing as, like, why is Chris Rock... Why hasn't Chris Rock really made it beyond his stand-up act? Because his stand-up act is a thing of beauty. And passion, and it's very raw and real. That's him.
That's him up there. Every time they put him into something else, it just misses because it's not him anymore. It's him sanitized or it's him not with his own voice. And there's a million different examples of that.
Just real quick on that particular subject. Have you ever broken down Chris Rock's? I was once hired to write a movie for Chris Rock. Okay. And so I got a bunch of his stand-up and I was listening to his stand-up. And I started breaking down, like, okay, how does the guy talk? Like, how would you actually deliver this in a dramatic form? And the problem that I ran into is his comedy is all about repetition. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to his stage act, it'll be like, water bottles, huge laugh. Water bottles, huge laugh.
Motherfucking water bottle.
Right. And then at a certain point, like, and people know his act enough that they know that they are anticipating something great is coming about water bottles and he's not letting them have it yet. And then when it comes, it's really funny. But like, if you actually go sort of jokes per page if you transcribed his act and you said actual things that have funny content that you can read per page in a Chris Rock stand-up act, it's like one thing in three pages, right? And the rest of it is just his attitude and who he is on stage. And so I think that's a great example of something. You can't turn around and do that and you can't turn around and write that and expect the same thing. And if you do this particular explanation that I'm doing right now to an executive, like, you lost them in the first sentence. Like, what do you mean? Like, you transcribe the... No, you just do Chris Rock. It's great. No, but you see, if you do the thing... What are you talking about? Just do it. Right.
Yeah. The reason I wanted to get into the stuff that you called the shit a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'll actually start with David on this because I think you'll have
more shit.
No, I think you'll be able to speak to this in regard to the notes that you received on the Oaks during that pilot, because I would imagine, you know, with the Nancy McKeon stuff, with especially with casting, but also during the process of writing the script or getting notes on the script, you get some great stuff, and you get some terrible stuff. So I'd like to hear about how each of you guys have had the creative relationship with the network. But let's start with the notes that you received on the Oaks.
Oh, God.
That you reacted strongly to.
Well, so many of them were given to me probably 12 hours before the writer's strike. So I typed very, very slowly. But, you know, we talk about, these guys are talking about casting, and it's really, I mean, that's 90% of what you're getting. You know, stupid, I mean, you know, it's about this family that's haunted by a ghost, and this little girl, like this 10-year-old girl, like the trope, you know, she needs to be very haunted, and that's the series. And the note we got was, the girl that we chose, she was too haunted. She wasn't, and it was those kind of... I was not... Sean Ryan was my executive producer, and Sean doesn't answer emails. He doesn't, like, return calls.
And I've been trying to get him for the series.
But
I know.
But it's very calculated. I had a knee-jerk reaction to every bad note, every bad cast, and I was at a fever pitch the entire time. Sean... And by the time Sean would answer an email, the problem had already passed. Mm-hmm. Or someone else had already intervened that was more suited to answer that question. So more than the bad notes that I got, I just reacted to them as poorly as possible. There's a way to get bad notes and ignore them, incorporate them in a way that you... I mean, these guys can attest to that, but, you know, I'm a great example of what not to do, you know. So,
well, thanks for being
more
here.
Than the bad notes that I got, the way that I handled them was far worse. And it's stupid and petty. And I cut my nose off. I said, "Oh, you want me to do that stupid thing? It's going to ruin the show, and I'm going to show you how it's going to ruin the show." Yeah. So I did it and said, "Fuck you." And then we did a writer's strike, and I couldn't change it. So, you know, yeah, that was my great experience.
Matt, rather than go into Burn Notice, I'm curious about the kinds of network notes, because you made, then after Burn Notice, made the leap to Fox, a major network for The Good Guys.
What was the relationship like with the network during the process and once the show was on the air as well?
I mean, actually, they were pretty... what's the best way to put this? No, actually, the truth is, I pretty much have a policy with notes calls. If I get a note, my reaction is always some version of, oh, okay, all right, let's take a look at that. All right, let's see what we can do. And if I like it, I'll say, oh, great, okay, that's a terrific idea, I'll do that. And if I hate it, I actually do discipline myself to always say, all right, well, let me take a look at that. And I guess in my experience, there's always... If you're not dealing with total idiots, and sometimes you are, but fortunately in my two television shows, I have not dealt with total idiots. You may be dealing with very smart people who have very little time. You may be dealing with obscure political agendas or things happening behind the scenes that you're not privy to. You may be dealing with all sorts of things, but you don't necessarily know what you're dealing with when you get the note. And reacting really quickly to them, it does, like, you may blast someone who's being forced to give you the note at gunpoint, and you've just made an enemy of the one person who could have been your ally in fighting the note. And that's something that you kind of only learn through experience. And so in that case, basically my policy is, if I don't agree with a note, and there were notes that I didn't agree with on The Good Guys, but if I don't agree with a note, and on Burn Notice, but... then I will simply go in and fix it the way that I think it should be fixed. However, I sort of start with the idea that if somebody cared about it enough to give me a note, then I'm going to really legitimately try to address it in some way, shape, or form. And you're absolutely right. I mean, if you passive aggressively take a note, two things can happen. You can turn it in and they love it and you're fucked. Or you can turn it in and they hate it and you're fucked. There's no way you can win if you just do something you don't believe in. And so I just, you know, sort of went with my policy from Burn Notice that I'd learned on Burn Notice of just do what you think needs to be done. And if somebody cares enough to give the note, give it a look and figure out what you would do to address that or make that better. And I can't even count the number of times that I've been given a note and I've actually done the exact opposite of the note. But that combined with a sort of friendly pitch as to why doing the exact opposite of what you told me was actually doing what you said on a deeper level, you'd be surprised how many times that works. And because the truth is, it doesn't, in my experience, it doesn't do you any good to go into that relationship deciding that you're working with idiots. Because even if it isn't true, you will make it true. You can turn an executive into an idiot very easily. And the great thing, actually, is when you're the easy call for the network, and when you keep your powder dry and you only really fight when it really matters. I had learned this great lesson on Burn Notice where... If I really, really, really disagreed with something and if I really, really, really had to fight it for real, I couldn't take the note in any way, shape, or form. I would write out a reasoned argument and it didn't matter how long it took and just say exactly why I thought what I thought and then say, hey, you know, make your call. You're the boss. But here is 7 pages about why... You should not do why we should not do that. And I realized I'd sort of won that battle when at the end of the first year of Burn Notice, I sent one of the 3 missives like that I sent that year, and the head of the network didn't even read it. He just said, oh, it's one of Matt's things. Let him do what he wants, right? And basically figuring if it was really that important to me, I'd given him everything he wanted whenever it was legit. He was just kind of like, yeah, whatever. He can have it. As long as he heard that part of the note, it's fine. And so on The Good Guys... You know, once I had my head around that particular set of people and what they wanted, but you kind of have to listen deeply to the politics behind the scenes, who's talking to whom, how they're interacting, and what's really going on, and take the notes it's a cliche, but it's true. Then whatever the note behind the note is, and ideally you can reach the point where, you know, by the end, a note's calling the good guys, and it had something to do with the fact that the show was failing. The notes calls on the good guys were 20 minutes long. And once your executives are only allotting 20 minutes for a notes call, which consists of 5 minutes of joking around and 5 minutes of wrapping up what you said, so it's really just 10 minutes of discussion, you've won the battle. I mean, they read the script an hour ago, they give you whatever notes they had in the 20 minutes, and then you're done. So, but it, that you kind of have to, you got to be the good guy for a long time to earn that.
Peter, has this been your experience as well? And I'd be interested to hear as well the kinds of the relationship that you guys had with FX as opposed to, say, one of the major networks.
The FX relationship was the best I've ever had
in
my entire career, in that John Landgraf, who's the head of FX, would actually give us notes, very few of them, and every now and then would give you a note that would actually save the episode. So that's never happened in my experience. I've never had somebody actually help me out in the course of trying to figure out what to do. I have in the past had a very contentious relationship with network executives, and I'm not going to bore you with some of the stories that involve gunplay, but everything that Matt said is true. You don't know where these notes are coming from, and ultimately one of the problems is interpretation. And also the understanding several things about television, especially. One is, it's not art. There can be art in it, but it's a business. And if you want to be an artist, start painting, you know, because this is not a place for artists. It's a place where you can approximate art, but ultimately you are in a business. And you're talking to people who are not in the same business as you are. You think you're in the same business, but you're not. You're making flowers or you're selling flowers and they're selling concrete. And you're just trying to figure out a way to get along. You know, it's a complete communication problem. I recently talked to my therapist after hanging up on a notes call about 3 weeks ago. So I still haven't fucking learned. And I said, why do I do that? Why do I do that? And he said to me, do you know this martial art, Aikido? And I said, well, I know all the martial arts. Fuck with me and find out. So I went all ghetto on his ass for a little bit. But he said Aikido is, I guess I'm going to get this wrong, but it's not about fighting. You know, it's not about pushing energy this way. It's about dealing with the energy that comes this way and deflecting it. Right? How am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay. And I went, that's it. These notes aren't meant as a personal attack. I just merely need to deflect them, watch them as they pass. And the way you do that is exactly what Matt said. That's interesting. I'll take a look at that. That's exactly it. I never learned to say that's interesting. I'll take a look at that. I'd always want to talk about the note. And when you talk about it, that means the network person who gave you the note has to talk more. And eventually, at about the 15-second mark, they will expose their idiocy because they really have nothing to say, and they'll then resent you for that. So it's a mess. It's just a mess. It's better just to say, that's interesting. I'll look at that.
Well, actually, though, real quick, in my experience, the thing that I had to learn was the stupider a note is, the more important it is that you don't resist it. Because the problem is, if somebody says on Rescue Me, like, maybe they should stop being firemen this week and they can all, and it would be like a fun special episode where they all become ballet dancers for the week. And now if you resist that, you are going to embarrass the fuck out of someone that you have to deal with every day for the rest of the duration of the show. So the stupider the note is, like, the more someone hasn't thought about it or whatever, the more they're going to have to double down if you resist them, because you just made them look like idiots on a notes call. And it's never just you and one other person on a notes call. It's you and 10 other people on a notes call early in the process. And once you're into the series, it's you and three or four other people on the notes call. And God forbid someone say something really stupid and then have to justify why, no, they have to be ballet dancers. And why are you being such a prick? And, you know, that kind of thing. And so, if you want to let it go, you better not resist it, because you those people can't afford to look like idiots. And so, because that's their jobs on the line. So if you really call somebody out and say, hey, this is a really stupid note. If you are right, they could lose their job. And so if somebody says a really stupid note, that's the time to say, wow, you know what? Can I call you back? And I want to think about that a little bit more, and I want to go through the ideas, and I'm just going to call you back and we can talk about this a little bit more. Can we just put a pin in that one a little bit? We'll figure it out later, right? And then you can call them back and sort of talk them slowly through.
Very good. Very diplomatic.
Yeah. Well, you just talk them slowly through that, and you say why, like, their instinct was really good and why you're totally running with that, and you're going to make them look great, right? You're going to make them look smart. You're going to enhance their ability to do their job. But that's the thing. Like, I learned my lesson on features. Doing, because, you know, resisting notes and stuff, and, you know, it, in features, it's very simple and very ruthless. You're just gone. You're fired, right? That you're not working with those people forever. They replace you, and it's so brutal in features where you're replaced, and then they just never call you again. So you can literally be on a job, and then like, oh, I read in the paper that I've been replaced. Terrific. Will I ever hear from those people again? No, not for 10 years. At which point they call you and act like nothing happened.
Yeah. I don't remember it that way.
Yeah.
I seem to think you went through all your steps on that project. Right? Nothing but good things.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah. I just have one more question. And David, I'm going to let you lead us into it, because we were talking earlier about the dire straits of being a writer in Hollywood right now.
Not for me.
But for all of us.
Right, yes. I'm fine.
Worry about David Schulman,
yeah, everyone.
You're not going to make it to your car.
Maybe in a couple of years, very well.
Bidding war.
It's, I'm different from these guys. I've been on staff every year for 10 years. And I feel very lucky. I feel very lucky to have gotten in how I did, when I did. There's a lot of talk about white guys, pilots, white guys, whatever, white guys. And it's true. There's a lot of white guys writing for TV, and the networks have, have a mandate, to open the doors to writers of color, female writers, diversity writers. And there's never been a better time. There's never been a better time for those writers
to not be a white guy.
For those writers to get a break that they didn't have before.
Yeah. It's been a long time coming, and it's due.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's also, if you're a white guy,
you know, you really have to. You have to do something else. You have to wow them with a movie spec or a TV spec, but you know, there's a lot of pressure from the showrunners to hire. You know, you need to fill out your staff. And the network's going to pay for your staff writer, your diversity staff writer. They're going to pay for your female staff writer story, you know. So the pendulum has swung. As far as the pendulum swung one way, it swung just as far the other way. One day we'll reach that kind of middle ground. But until then, there's just the overcompensation that'll keep swinging.
Yeah, and we've talked in recent weeks, if you guys have been here, about how staffs are smaller. You know, there may be more narrative shows on the air, but the staffs are getting smaller. So I want to talk to Matt and to Peter. You guys are in the position to hire your staffs. What do you look for? How does someone sell himself in the interview?
Either in an interview, I haven't. I haven't had to put a staff together in years, because on the job and on Rescue Me, there was no staff.
Really?
It was really just Dennis and I and one other guy. So we never had a staff. But I have two pilots that are looking good, which means, of course, they're both destined to fail at this point. But they're looking good, and I've really started to think about having to put together a staff. And I think primarily you're just looking for because they're both comedies, you're looking for a distinct comic voice. So, you know, and that's sometimes hard to put a finger on, but it's just somebody who you can tell in the just from looking at their writing, that they know that they just know how to be funny, and there's some aspect of their own personality in it. It's not funny like any other person. You know, it's just something that breathes, lives and breathes on the page, and you can see it. You know, you can definitely see it. You pray to find those people who have their own comic voice, you know. Sometimes that's hard to find. That's why I think a spec script, which has for years and years been the you know, the acknowledged way of getting into the business, is crippling in a way, because you a successful spec script, just like supposedly mine on Murphy Brown, exactly mirrored one of the actual scripts on the show. I mean, they said it looked just like one of our scripts. So your ability to assimilate is highly prized, as is your ability to show what an individual you are. So those two things don't necessarily go together. But that's sort of what I'm looking for. And then it's beyond that in terms of meeting the person. You just want to see that they're clean. That helps, because you're going to be stuck in a room with them, and that they don't come right in with, you know, the Satan worship or the 9/11 theories or all that stuff. Where you're going, I'm going to have to listen to this all the time. You know, so that's mostly it. It's fairly simple. Once they good writing, I don't. Even if they stink a little, I'll be like, okay, just leave a window open. I don't care.
I put together two staffs, one for Bernadette and one for the good guys. And I will say I come to it from a little bit of a different perspective, because both of my shows are remote location shows. Bernadette shoots in Miami, and the good guys shot in Dallas. So it didn't matter who I was hiring. Anybody that I hired needed to be able to write a script and then go to that location. All of my writers are always on location the entire time while it's shooting, and they had to produce the script. And it also meant that, like, and I delegate a lot of power to my writers because I have to, because I can't, I mean, especially last year, I'm running two shows at a time. I can't take calls about costumes. If such and such a scene needs to be changed to another location in order for the shooting to work, that's a decision that needs to be made by the writer and confirmed by me, not made by me and then confirmed by the writer. And so that means that when I'm hiring somebody from top to bottom, I am hiring someone who I am saying, you go out and you speak with my voice. Like, you have the authority, staff writer, of the executive producer when you are in Miami. And so that means that a lot of staffs are hiring, I'm not really a sports fan, but I'll use the analogy anyway. They're hiring baseball teams, right? They're putting together, they need a third baseman, they need a pitcher, they need a catcher, all these different skills, and then they put it all together and it becomes a baseball team. I hire basketball teams. People might have a specific thing they do that's a little different, but everybody's scoring. Everybody's passing. Everybody's running up the court and down the court. That's the way it works. And so for me, I look for a big thing I look for is just personal affinity. Like, is this somebody that I feel will go and I can trust to speak with my voice, who I think can handle actors, who I think can handle producers, who can be diplomatic, who can make decisions, who has the leadership qualities to produce. And that's a very rare thing. I mean, most shows don't need to do that. I happen to need to do that. And then somebody who has a unique voice but can sound like me. I mean, that's a huge thing. Like, my shows are very voicey. They sound like me. So you got to be able to sound like me. And I can't send somebody out to change lines on set. You know, somebody's got a 5 a.m. call in Miami and they have to call me to change a line, they got to call me at 3 in the morning or 2 in the morning. It's not going to happen, right? So I need people who I can trust if they need to change a line on set and I can never hear it until we see it in the editing room. They have to speak with my voice. So that's the other thing I'm looking for. So I'd say leadership, ability to mimic me. And then the other big thing is just raw ass busting, and respect for the job. I think that, like, I only hire patriots. I don't want mercenaries. There are a lot of mercenaries in town. And if you want to work on Burn Notice, like, what do we talk about at work? We talk about Burn Notice. What do we talk about at lunch? Burn Notice. When we go out for drinks after work, we talk about Burn Notice. Like, we live and breathe that fucking show. That's all we do, right? Same thing on The Good Guys. Everybody was a patriot on The Good Guys. And when I've had a few mercenaries over the years who were just punching a clock and doing a job, and they're not working on my shows anymore. They may be great writers. They're just not people that I can use particularly, because I need people who live it, breathe it, think it all the time. And the last thing is speed. There are actually a couple guys here who worked on The Good Guys, and a big thing for them, the one thing I knew because of the whole like white guy thing was that I could not hire a white guy writing team. Like, that was not going to happen. But I was interested in developing with these guys, and so they were because they'd worked on The Oaks, actually. And I knew that they had done a lot of ass-busting on The Oaks as the writer's assistants on The Oaks. And so we knew some people in common. And so I brought them in, and I said, oh, well, I'm interested in talking about this project. And every time I gave them notes, they'd call me 9 a.m. the next morning. Done. Right? Send me the document. Done. Turn it around right away. Done. So when I had to put together a staff, well, yeah, we'd really prefer you not hire this writing team because white guys, and you know how it is. And I was like, yeah, well, fuck you, because I have to. Because, and they ended up, how many did you guys write last year?
Four.
Yeah, they wrote 4 of 20 episodes for their first job in television. And why? Because when we were behind the eight ball and I needed an episode, they came back from Dallas. I needed an episode 7 days later. A number of things had gone wrong, and I said, guys, I need you to write an episode in 7 days. 7 days later, they went back to Dallas with a completed episode. Turned out great.
Sir? I'm thinking about Burn Notice. Oh.
I think we all are.
Right now.
No one here isn't.
I don't give a shit about the questions. I'm thinking about Burn Notice.
Hired.
Thank you.
How fast can you turn around a script?
Another game.
That's my question. How fast can you turn around a script?
I've done them I was a younger person. But I, when I did Larry Sanders, and it was a year I did not work on the show. I mean, I always had a producing credit, even though I wasn't there all the time. Well, I think in the fourth or fifth season, I think we did 13 shows. I wrote 4 of them. I was not on staff. I wrote a third of the season, and several, I would say, at least 3 of those in under 24 hours.
Ridiculous.
Like, I get a call on Friday, and Gary would say, we don't have a script for Monday. And I go, well, what stories do you have? Well, we have sort of this, sort of this, and sort of this. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow. And I would bring a draft to his house. We'd go through it, make changes. And then that would go to the table and then shoot by the end of the week. And that happened more times than I can tell you. And boy, was I compensated. Hello.
Really? All right, let's go to you guys. Questions out here. Anyone? Really?
Come on, you motherfuckers.
I cannot shut you up. Yes. The question is, what's a good way to chart this course? How do you get into the room as a writer or as a writer's assistant, are you saying? Or once you are an assistant, to become a writer? What can you guys offer?
I'd say 2 things. One, there's a lot of focus on becoming a writer's assistant because it seems like a step to a job. And people, recent college graduates, not necessarily you, but tend to think in terms of what is the thing that I do in order to get the thing that I want. And the answer really is write a great script and make me staff you, right? The truth is, experience in the writer's room is less important than you think it is. The first time I was in a writer's room was when I ran it, right? It's not like people think that that's this really big skill that you have to acquire. It's like talking story with your friends. I mean, it's not, or with your enemies on some staffs, but that's basically the dynamic. I'd say that there are advantages to being known to people, but ultimately, once you're a writer's assistant, you're working a lot and you may not be writing your own stuff. And ultimately that's what you got to do to get onto a staff, unless you get really lucky, which occasionally happens. But I wouldn't gamble your career on it.
I would agree with that. I would say that when I said Rescue Me, it was really 3 guys. The third guy was our writer's assistant on the job, who then started as our writer's assistant on Rescue Me and finally said, I think I could write this. And we said, please, because, we're dying. It's only 2 of us. And he did, and he was great. And he's now working on The Walking Dead, and, he's got a whole career going. But I agree with you, though, that that's a very rare story. And that
you should, I think it's important when you're young and starting out that you pick something that you want to do and then do it. Don't do a thing like it.
Yeah.
And so I would, if I was starting out now, I would write something fucking funny that was under 5 minutes and make it and put it on YouTube. That's what I'd do. There's my writing sample right there. And I'd send out the website address or whatever it is. And, you know, I'd get a bunch of friends and, you know, actors and people who, you know, people who wanted to act and people who wanted to direct and people who wanted to use a camera and all that sort of stuff. And I'd make the thing and I'd put it up there. It'd be the best damn 5 minutes I could make. And you'd think that would get seen. Also, would development executives or studio people or whatever rather watch something done on a website for 5 minutes that they can turn off after 30 seconds if they don't like it, or read your script? Which one of those do you think they want to do? Yeah, they'd rather go and go. And either they stick for the whole 5 minutes, they go, I got to meet that guy, or whatever happens. That's what I would do.
Actually, that's in addition to their work on The Oaks, which I just heard about. Aaron and Wade in the audience had done a series of shorts. And again, there were all sorts of reasons not to hire them, but I was doing a comedic cop show and they'd made a series of comedic cop shorts. What was I going to do? You know what I mean? Like,
they're pretty much daring you. With that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't, there's nothing else you can do. And so it's the other thing is, as a writer's assistant, you can't really choose which show you get on. So like, what if you're the writer's assistant on Grey's Anatomy and you're not a Grey's Anatomy? I mean, I could be the writer's assistant on Grey's Anatomy for 500 years and never get a job on Grey's Anatomy. It's just not my, it's a good show. It's just not what I write.
Or you could just be in a shitty show.
Yeah.
You know, with some asshole who, you know, doesn't have a family and wants to work until 4 o'clock in the morning every time, and you're stuck there.
Yeah.
You know, not, you know, and being told probably don't, you know, nobody wants to hear your ideas. That'll be good.
And I would add,
it's a sucky job.
And I would add to, you know, have this short, this 5 minute video, whatever it is, that's your calling card, but you better have
then
a script,
you better have
to,
script to back it up. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can look to David's experience with The Oaks as sort of this story writ large, you know, where it's you wrote this spec that everybody wanted to get their hands in.
Or a play.
Yeah, or the play.
Or a short story, or just whatever you're most passionate about, whatever story you want to tell, that's you have to tell it.
And the other thing to keep in mind, were you here when Jane Espenson was here a few weeks ago?
No.
And
no,
Jane,
I met her a couple of times and she gave me the same advice.
Yeah. I mean, and one thing she brought up is, you know, as an unemployed writer, you have so much more time than an employed writer. Mm-hmm. So get that script right. Get that spec right.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the back. The question is about, you know, once people have taken notice, do you need to bring a showrunner into you to go sell your own show? What do you guys think? And are you asking them? Because they have shows already.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, if you're going to get these things made with these people, you're going to have to bring on a showrunner. That's what it sounds like, right?
Well, no, actually, my question is, for instance, I'm open to having a showrunner.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't know how to actually approach. I actually had a show once where my manager put me with a showrunner, and it was the worst match ever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I'm going to put somebody with a showrunner, I really want to be able to say, this is the person that, you know, like you said, in front of us, they understand my voice, they understand that this can be a success and continue it. So I guess I don't even know how to...
It's pretty. I mean, you've already said that the main part of it is a chemistry issue. Yeah. Mostly, it's finding somebody who you feel, first of all, hears your voice and respects it. That's a big part of it, and somebody who you feel you have some sort of connection with that you can at least communicate, because you're going to be communicating your ass off as soon as you start doing whatever you're doing. So if you have that connection, hopefully that'll carry you through. But you just got to be careful. You got to make sure you get up with the right person. And that's like having an agent. It's the same thing, although all agents suck. But I mean, you want at least one that's not going to kill you or something.
The only other thing I'd say, and this is just an unfortunate reality, often you just need a showrunner in television is like saying you just need a director in features. It's a way of saying no without saying no, right? Because basically in television – the scarce commodity is showrunners that are trusted by networks. So in a way, they're saying, a lot of times when people say that, they're saying, hey, if you can go out and get someone who is the sort of person that that we make things with regardless of what they bring us, then sure, we'll do it. Because we'll do anything if you bring us a showrunner of a particular stature that that showrunner wants to do. So basically, they're saying, you go sell it to someone who can sell to us, a lot of times. With regard to that marriage, though, I think it would be... When you hear networks talk about this, about pairing showrunners, they really like the idea that showrunner is this job you do that is kind of like can be done in various contexts in the same way, that there's some sort of the showrunner system that I use to run this show. And it's just not the case. I think if they would be better served by saying, go out and find a writing partner who's run a show before. Because that's really what it is. I mean, you should choose a showrunner like you'd choose a writing partner or a wife.
And use it as a, I mean, you know, when I sold my pilot, they were like, you know, you need a showrunner. I was like, great, give me one. No, I don't know who wants to do this job by themselves. Hmm. It is the hardest fucking job in the world. And to have someone do it with you, all the better. To have someone you can learn from, it's going to be invaluable. I mean, Sean Ryan and I could not be more different as people, as writers. We're different on every level. But he probably has more integrity than anyone I've ever met.
Thanks, man.
including Matt. We would approach scenes completely differently. But I was like, I can learn. There's always a learning opportunity. Even if you get paired with someone you don't like, there's anyone with more experience. You can. I've learned a lot this panel. There's just take those opportunities to open your mind. It's not done the way you want to do it, but there's so many ways you can learn, and just the next show you'll be better.
Great. Yeah, the question is about TV versus feature writing, and it sounds like the process and the business. How do they differ?
I'll take this.
You do both successfully, so let's hear it.
I had a career path all planned out that I was going to do television, and then as I got older, and I didn't want it because it's really, you know, it's a very difficult job. And now I'm just a worn out husk of a man. Really, the business ate away at me. So I decided I'll go into features, you know. And I started doing it. I don't even know how. I don't remember how, but I started rewriting and doctoring scripts and a lot of things. A lot of shit, by the way. Analyze This is probably the best movie of the other than a movie I made by myself, which I consider to be pretty good, although who knows, it probably fucking sucks. But... And that's what I thought I would do because to me, feature writing is much more humane. You have much more time to work. It's not the machine that television is. Television is just like a grind, week after week after week, you're pumping out material. Whereas in a feature, you can actually stop and think and work, and you've got a month, 2 months, or whatever, to write the script or whatever. And then what happened with my master plan was that all of a sudden I looked around and features suck. I mean, look at the movie business now. It's horrible. There's absolutely nothing to write. Unless you like sci-fi, or if you like big tentpole things like that, then there's stuff to write. You can't get... I mean, if I wanted to make a smaller character comedy or something like that, I can't get it made. I cannot get it made. I've got scripts that everybody goes, this is a great script. What a great script. Never going to get made. Never. So I had to go back to television. I had to go back. At this advanced age, I had to go back. I'm 52 years old. When I started in television 22 years ago, I was late. I started at 30. But when I started, I remember distinctly a guy on staff who is approaching my age now getting a facelift so that he wouldn't look his age. So I don't know what the fuck I'm still
doing. We're lucky to have you here tonight.
I know.
Frankly.
I should be dead.
It's surprising you made
dead
it down.
Out of the business. So it's a much more humane. That's the difference. It's much more humane, it seems to me, in terms of the amount of. There's still still the creative struggles and the difference in doing good work, that's always going to be a problem. But at least you have the time to, if you fail, it can't be because you were rushed usually. You know, but of course, anything can happen. Everything's a disaster. But the problem right now is just what's being made. And there's just not much of it. There's not a lot of output. And what is being put out is always very, there's a very narrow bandwidth of what's being made and what's succeeding. And when it breaks out, when it becomes something different, it's only because one thing happened. Like, for example, what was the Hangover a couple years ago? That all of a sudden ushered in a whole rash of R-rated kind of comedies. And that's sort of running its course now, and then there'll hopefully be something else. But it's just tough to do good stuff.
Yeah, I'd say from a – are you really more asking from a creative perspective or a business perspective, or what's your – what's the –
creative. Yeah.
I mean, I'd say that two things. I mean, one, I will second, the feature business sucks. It is a humane lifestyle. It's kind of nice writing a feature, and there are attractions to it. If, though, you want to see things that you do get made, if you have that drive, you can't beat television. I mean, it's just like you're doing it every week. Last year, I made 38 episodes of television and a TV movie, right? In the preceding 8 years before my television career, like, never, usually writing two movies at once, I made 0 hours of anything, right? And that's typical. I mean, that's not like, and you know, that's just the way it works, because they're developing 20 things for every one that gets made. But from a creative perspective, the one thing I'd say, the shorthand, I think, is if you tend to think in terms of big resolvable conflicts, and these days they need to be really big, really resolvable external conflicts of a particular kind, then that's a movie. And if you think in terms of ongoing unresolvable conflicts, things that you can just do every week, you know, whether it's on a procedural level, like Law and Order can go on forever because crime's not going to stop, right? And on a character level, you know, you take a show like House. Like, House is not going to wake up one morning and go, like, I'm not grumpy anymore, and I'm just a happy guy. I mean, he did for a couple episodes, I guess. But eventually, that's all about an unresolvable conflict in a man's soul. And actually, Rescue Me is a wonderful example of that. Despite your decrepitude,
yes.
No, I mean, whatever the limitations of its creator, it was a terrific example.
Larry's not here to defend himself.
It was a terrific example of a show that was. It had there were certainly external conflicts in the show, but it was all about this inordinately unresolvable conflict. That guy was never going to get better. So you could just do that forever, and that's a great way to tell if you tend to think in terms of those stories, then you're probably going to have an easier time in TV. And if you tend to think in terms of great big resolvable conflicts, you know, and you see shows like, you know, good show, but The Event was a great example of when you take a feature idea and put it in television. It's a great big resolvable conflict. And you put it in television, and it's kind of hard to do it for 10 years. So
1 year.
1 year, yeah.
I think we have time for one more. Is this an awesome question?
It's a pretty cool question, I think. I'm hoping.
We'll see.
Well, I was recently reading on John August's blog. They were talking about establishing your brand. And I wanted to ask you, as a television writer, do you feel that you have to establish a brand? And if so, how narrow or expanded is that brand?
That's an all right question.
Establish a brand.
This is what we're told now. Establish a brand. Have you guys stumbled upon a brand, or did you set out to have a brand to your writing?
They give you one. I don't think you need to...
Well, you have a deal.
I don't think you need to worry about establishing it, because people are all too quick to pigeonhole you and put you in a little... I'm the character guy. Like, literally, I said I wanted to write on this... I have this great thing, an overall deal, you're at a network, and you can develop for them, or they place you on a show, you have job stability, And I read all their shows, and I said, this great character show that I want to do. And they said, we already have those people. We have this big sci-fi monolith, and they don't have any character writers. So you're going to go there. You know.
I'm sure John means something good by this, by brand. But it seems exactly that everybody in the business is so anxious to pigeonhole you. Why beat them to the punch? Mm-hmm. You know, why not just try to keep things open? Now it's okay if there are things that you like to do. I mean, I guess I would be the dark, edgy comedy pissed off guy, I guess. You look at Sanders.
I don't see that.
You look at Larry Sanders and the To Rescue Me, and the, you know, it's all kind of that. I'm not doing, you know, family stuff. Although now I am now, but
well, yeah, you won't have the opportunity to. People don't give you a bunch of choices like after Burn Notice, here's a menu of shows you can create. I mean, there's a certain logic to, you know, I clearly have a brand at this point of, you know, shows in which things explode. Some sort of clever crime-fighting thing with some mixture of comedy and drama, more or less, on, you know. But that's a brand that I established with, let's call it a show and a half. I mean, like, two shows, one lasting a year, one, you know.
Matt, when you did Burn Notice, did you feel like you could get that made because you're the guy who did, you did Good Guys. You're the guy who did Burn Notice. Good Guys has a lot of those elements. Did you feel like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, clearly, like, the Good Guys could happen because of Burn Notice. But previous to that, just, you know, John is he's done some television, but he's primarily a feature writer. Previous to writing Burn Notice, which, you know, like, had something to do with a resurgence of action in television, I had written exactly zero action movies. None. Not one time, right? And now in features, right, when people talk to me about features, I'm an action guy. Like, people talk to me about action things because that's what I do in television. And clearly, I've always done that, right? When I was in a weird thing for me was when I was in features, I had two simultaneous pigeonholes because there are these different groups of executives and they don't really cross-pollinate a whole lot. So I was simultaneously the super dark NC-17 indie film, like, semi-comedy drama guy and the bright children's film writer. And then sort of toward the tail end of that, also the broad comedy writer, like the broad, you know, sort of like guy comedy writer. And people, like, just different sets of people knew me, and so I was sort of separately branded in these different areas in Hollywood. And if you'd asked any of the people that knew me as a children's film writer, they would have said, oh no, he's far too soft to write an NC-17 indie film. And then the NC-17 indie film people would have laughed at the idea that I could write a children's film. So the only thing I will say is pigeonholes pay well. I mean, it's true. Like, if you're pigeonholed at something and you become like the... you know, the angry guy, comedy, television guy, well, you know, if somebody's got that show or they want that, well, there's a premier guy. And so you're going to pay.
That's what they say when they call.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what they say. They say, we just want to bring a little bit of Rescue Me into this.
And if you care to do it, then you can say, like, break out your checkbook. And
that's
then,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's...
I got the Rescue Me right here.
Yeah.
I got it. Where's the check?
Yeah.
It's Hansel and Gretel. I know that's a weird choice, but I'll do it. So the witch is there. All right. What the fuck? What are you kids doing here? Get away from my fucking house. I could just channel Leary for the whole thing.
Does the witch's...
You gotta push me in the oven? Fuck you.
Does the witch's girlfriend have to be black?
No. No, she's just been... We'll leave her in the oven a little less. How's that?
Well, clearly that's it, folks. We just need to thank 826LA. Please visit them at 826LA.org. We need to thank Ed and Emily and Chris and everyone here at Nerdist Industries. My name is Ben Blacker, and thanks to our panelists, what's your name, Matt Nix, David Schulner, and turning 100 this week, Peter Tolan.
Matt Ball.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.